Welcome to our podcast today on the dark side of the Middle East. I'm Sarah Al-Sidi, the Middle East Events Officer, and today with me are Bradley Hope and Justin Sheck, authors of Blood and Oil, who will talk to us about individuals in power in the Middle East, particularly Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Bradley is the co-author of Billion Dollar Whale and Blood and Oil. He spent 7 years at the Wall Street Journal's offices in New York and London. Before that, he covered the Arab Spring from Cairo, Tripoli, and Beirut. He is a Pulitzer finalist and a winner of the Gerald Loeb Award for International Reporting. Justin Sheck has worked at the Wall Street Journal since 2007, first in San Francisco and later in London and New York. He covers Silicon Valley tech companies, white-collar crime, blue-collar crime, mining, and oil companies, and currently works on international financial investigations. He has been writing about Saudi Arabia since 2016. Sheck graduated from Bates College and worked at small newspapers in California, beginning with the Calaveras Enterprise before starting at Journal. He is a Pulitzer Prize finalist and an Emmy nominee. I will now hand over to our two speakers, and I'll ask them firstly to tell us a little bit about their book, Blood and Oil, and what compelled the two of you to write it.
I think I'll just start then. Well, thank you very much. You know, Justin and I were both working on covering Saudi Arabia, especially during the Aramco IPO days, because obviously both of us were at the Wall Street Journal in London. And that was kind of the starting point. You know, this company, the biggest, it was going to be the biggest IPO in the history of the financial world. And journalists around the world were trying to dig into that and understand what this company was and who's behind it. And inevitably, in modern Saudi Arabia, the first thing you would come to is the Crown Prince. He had become such a powerful figure already, and you know, with the rise of his father as the king. So, you know, right away after he took over, or after his father took over as king, Mohammed bin Salman started taking over all of the economic portfolios, and he installed himself as the ultimate power above Aramco. So that was our starting point. And then we spent a couple of years, you know, writing about that, writing about the Crown Prince. And we were discussing maybe 6 months or so after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, whether or not it was time to do a deeper dive into who is Mohammed bin Salman, how did he get where he is now, what's he really like, and sort of starting from scratch, even though we thought we knew a lot about it, going back to the beginning. And we thought there would be a lot of value in doing something like that.
Yeah, and what I would add is, you know, I had been covering oil for a few years before that, and had always thought of Saudi Arabia as this sort of insular place that had been doing the same thing the same way for a very long time. For decades, they pumped oil, they sold it, and they used the money to empower the royal family and keep the people of Saudi Arabia relatively prosperous, and to have, you know, this very conservative Islamic sort of overarching social structure. And it was sort of change. They were like allergic to change. They were very inward looking. There was not a lot of movement in the way they did things. And then all of a sudden you had this prince who nobody had really heard of before, who was promising massive changes, both internally and externally, socially, economically, and with the way Saudi Arabia interacted with the rest of the world. So it was just such a huge departure from what we'd been used to that it was kind of a natural thing to gravitate toward.
Yes, and there was a lot of discussion at the time. There'd be presidents and leaders meeting with him and saying that obviously he was this great reformist. And is this a kind of image he was trying to portray of himself at the time?
Yeah, and I think I'll take this first, if it's okay. I think it's hard to overstate how important creating an image has been for him from the beginning. So I, you know, by the time we got to him, he had been very successful for years at creating an image internally and especially within the royal court as someone who gets things done, someone who moves quickly, is decisive, sets goals, achieves those goals, and disposes of anyone who gets in the way of it. And, you know, by the time we got to him, he was looking internationally to try to create an image internationally of someone who was an agent of change and of progress and of open-mindedness and someone who is going to take what he always refers to as, you know, a young country and kind of, you know, bring it to the next stage of being, you know, a peer of the US and the UK and the European countries in terms of the way it interacted internationally, to make it a less inward-looking place.
And do you think, both of you, that you find it a bit ironic that he was seen as a reformer of his kingdom, despite the fact that there were still death penalties given out, and there were suspicions, maybe not as great as the recent ones, on the silencing of freedom of expression and freedom of speech? Isn't it a bit ironic, do you think, that he was trying to portray himself like that?
I think in a sense it makes logical sense about the way that things were going on in Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman never saw himself as a political reformer. He saw himself as a social reformer. And so in a way, everything that's happening in Saudi Arabia was relieving the society from a lot of the pressure that was coming from the conservative religious establishment, but at the same time, giving no political rights, and even in a sense, restricting them further. So people can go to the movie theater, they can listen to music, they can gather in public in mixed sex environments, but they can't write on Twitter that they oppose the crown prince, you know, or anything even slightly related to that. So I think that's one thing people don't often grasp, is that he never had any plans for a democratization of Saudi Arabia, and neither do any of the other Gulf monarchies.
Yeah, and what I would add is, you know, it's not like you're a reformer or you're not a reformer. You know, I think that for me, at least, and I think probably a lot of people in the US or Europe, you know, I think of reform as meaning, you know, you can't really have true reform unless you have some kind of democratization or some level of participation in government by the people who live in the country. But as Bradley said, I don't think he sees it like that at all. And the truth is, he did change a lot of things that make it more pleasant for a lot of people in Saudi Arabia to live day to day. But just because he did that doesn't mean that, you know, the international community should expect him to give up any of the power he and his family hold. And in fact, he's consolidated power, and he's made the king more individually powerful than at any time, probably since the founding of the modern kingdom.
Yeah, I suppose obviously the way we see reform and the way he might do is clearly different, and it's something that I personally haven't considered before, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners probably wouldn't have either. But through this, do you think he ever had the world fooled? Because some of the world leaders were referring to him just as this reformist. And did people actually buy this at the beginning? Was it actually something credible?
Probably from the perspective of all these kind of business leaders and kind of columnists who came in to do an interview and a quick visit, they were pretty wowed. I mean, they were in a sense fooled, because they didn't get access to the bigger picture of what was going on in Saudi Arabia. They didn't quite grasp the extent to which Mohammed bin Salman was consolidating power and ending this somewhat informal system that is not democracy, but it's a way of dispersing power within the royal family. You know, different branches would control different parts of the government. They would all behind the scenes do something in Arabic called consultation or shura, and sort of move together as a unit. But under Mohammed bin Salman's kind of plans, because his ideas were so radical compared to the glacial pace that Saudi Arabia was evolving previously, he needed to sort of take all the power into his hands and move forward despite people's opposition, even within his own family. There's people in his own family who opposed women driving, for instance, not so much because they were really sexist against women, but more that they thought that Saudi society would rebel. And so he thought he had a much better sense of the street of Saudi Arabia, what people could accept and what they would accept, especially the youth. And also, you know, a lot of these people coming in, it was a pretty amazing change for Saudi Arabia, and they would have no way of knowing that at the same time Mohammed bin Salman was creating a sort of secret personal intelligence group that would kidnap people around the world, and we're talking about more or less Saudi people, or in the case of Khashoggi, kill somebody. That was something that was secret and concealed from people for a long time.
It's quite crazy to think about it, because you would not particularly expect that, considering what you would hear about him at the beginning. And I want to move on to talk a bit about his display of wealth, because he does not shy away from showing the world all his possessions and all his wealth. What is he trying to achieve by portraying himself as this wealthy, powerful figure?
Well, you know, I don't know how calculated he's been in terms of displaying wealth, because it, while there have been some other princes, there are some other princes like Al-Walid bin Talal is the one we think of who have been extremely ostentatious and want to appear more wealthy than they even are. Mohammed bin Salman hasn't done that, but what he's done is make a couple of very high profile purchases, which were done through a couple layers of like intermediaries and intermediary companies. It made it look as if he was trying to conceal them, but not really very effectively. And so they were, you know, revealed by journalists. And there was, you know, one of the world's most expensive homes, one of the world's most expensive yachts. I don't think he's actually doing it for show. I don't think he's trying to portray an image. It seems almost the opposite. Like it seemed as if the royal court didn't want the stuff to come out. But, you know, he's been interviewed about this a couple of times. It said something to the effect of like, look, I'm a really rich guy. Like that's, I have a lot of money, I spend it. And, you know, I think one way he has tried to contextualize it with the yacht is, you know, the yacht has become sort of an instrument of state. Like it's used for a lot of government meetings. It's used for a lot of official business. So it's not just an indulgence. You know, he hasn't talked much about the house. He obviously spent a lot on this painting attributed to Leonardo da Vinci, but I don't know that he's using wealth to make a show. I think he uses power, and he uses, you know, military power and his power over dissidents to project strength more.
So you wouldn't say that his wealth is an instrument that he uses, but rather just a feature of himself that he displays?
No, I would say it's absolutely an instrument he uses. I don't think he uses it for show. I don't think he uses wealth so much. I don't think he's trying to project wealth. I think he uses his wealth to basically do whatever he wants. Like he's very successful at getting done whatever he wants to get done. And the way he does that is with the, you know, seemingly endless pile of money he's got.
There's also a little bit of an element of Mohammed bin Salman, even though he's obviously always been very rich, you know, compared to most of the people on earth. He, relative to his cousins, was not the richest member of the royal family. And for probably much of his early days, could look upon his cousins and think, how do they have so much more than we do? And so as soon as, so in Saudi Arabia, when a new king comes into power, that king suddenly becomes mega rich in a way that was like, you know, many multiples over what they were before as just a prince or a crown prince. And so I think there's also a little bit of an element of like, almost like winning the lottery, you know? So suddenly he had more access to more money than you could ever imagine in a thousand lifetimes. And he just did what you might do as an impulsive 20 something is start buying a few things. And when you have billions of dollars, you don't buy small things, you buy yachts and chateaus and things like that. So there's definitely, that's him on a personal level, you know, showing his cousins like, now I'm the rich guy compared to you. And then on the strategic level, obviously he started spending in a way that no Saudi royal had ever spent before. You know, for example, empowering this sovereign wealth fund called the Public Investment Fund to start playing a big role in global finance, you know, big deals, the SoftBank Vision Fund, the Blackstone Infrastructure Fund, buying a stake of Uber, you know, becoming one of the biggest investors in Uber. That was really a way for a small country relative to the rest of the world to suddenly become a major player.
So would you say that his wealth was key for him to get involved into all these global affairs, for him to kind of get noticed?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, certainly. It's certainly important in terms of the reason that, you know, many, if not most of the world's most prominent bankers and business leaders came to Saudi Arabia when he had his first business conference, was they want access to his money. So the money is certainly important. But as Bradley said, you know, in terms of his rise to power, you know, he very much has this international presence, but his rise to power was very internal and was very much a set of familial challenges. And the way the wealth became more important in gaining power was within the family and being able to amass enough money for his branch of the family to be able to dole it out to, you know, different leaders to buy loyalty and to have that power within. So in terms of his rise, the wealth is more important as sort of a domestic tool. And we document to some extent how he built that. You know, his father was relatively, I hesitate to use the word poor, but his father didn't have the same kind of money as some of the older, very senior princes. And so they built out a whole, you know, Mohammed bin Salman built out a whole business network of real estate holdings and companies they own, you know, domestically and internationally, that created a base of wealth for the family, for his branch of the family. And that was very important internally, but internationally, yeah, the wealth, it's not his wealth anymore. It's the nation's wealth. You know, he controls, you know, the wealth of one of the world's richest countries almost, and he can kind of do whatever he wants with it. So certainly that's the way he attracts business leaders and politicians, and that overlapping class of, you know, people like Tony Blair, who, you know, is a former politician who now is involved in business and has gone back and forth to Saudi Arabia, is the promise of all this money to invest.
And obviously, we've talked about his wealth and his power, and something I want to touch on now is the topic that has kind of surrounded him for the past few months and years, and that is the Khashoggi murder. And it happened more than almost 3 years ago now. And I was just wondering, what do you think it says about him that he was able to get away with it when we've had this recent evidence from America that he was clearly directly involved with it, yet there was very little action taken against him?
Well, I think there's a few things to think about. One of them is that when we think about his responsibility, what we know for sure is that the unit that carried out this killing was a special unit that he created and invented to answer to himself at a time when he still didn't have the full power of the government, when he didn't have his own kind of people in charge of every part of the government, especially the intelligence and the Ministry of Interior. He created his own unit, essentially, which is referred to in a recent lawsuit as the Tiger Team or the Tiger Squad. So this is a direct kind of extension of his own power, this unit. So it's not like some distant part of the government did this. This is like his people did it. We don't know exactly what happened and what messages were sent and what the perceptions were of what was going on, but we do know that much. So I think there's a few things. Obviously, the Trump administration was very close with Mohammed bin Salman and had sort of hitched their foreign policy wagon to, you know, his foreign policy, and really considered him a key ally in the Middle East. So they essentially, Trump protected Mohammed bin Salman from greater consequences, as far as, you know, never sort of directly saying he thought that he was responsible, and just kind of in general giving him umbrage. But the other thing is, because Mohammed bin Salman had by that point so thoroughly consolidated power in Saudi Arabia, there really isn't an alternative. So if all the governments of the world were to sort of turn their backs on Mohammed bin Salman, what would happen? Well, not much, because there's not really, they couldn't force Mohammed bin Salman to leave office, because this wasn't a situation where he was chosen through a kind of process of some kind. He and his father and their people maneuvered themselves into this position. And once they got there, they made it impossible to remove them. Not that you can remove a king typically, but you could remove a crown prince. There could be a kind of lobbying process, a discussion among the royal family. But in this case, that really wouldn't work. So I think there's also kind of a reality check for most foreign governments, which is, on one hand, they feel outraged and they consider this such a gross violation of what they believe in as societies. But on the other hand, there's nothing they can really do about it other than express themselves. And so most governments have expressed themselves quite vociferously about this case, and that's as far as they really wanted to take it. I think the US has sanctioned many of the members of the group, and that's a kind of mild consequence because it doesn't really affect Mohammed bin Salman himself. Though my slightly contrarian view is that the public image consequences for Mohammed bin Salman are huge. I mean, he went from one of the world's great, quote, reformers to being compared to people like Saddam Hussein and Kim Jong-un and things like that. So that's something that's deeply damaging to him and to Saudi Arabia and to his future career as a global leader. So it's created a situation where he has to do a lot to be able to recover from that, or maybe he never will recover fully, but at least recover to some extent.
Yeah, I agree with that. All of that, of course. And one thing I would add is that, you know, from the U.S. perspective, in terms of punishing him, you know, there's a fundamental difference in approach between the Trump administration and the Biden administration to foreign policy. And, you know, a lot of the Biden people were working for Biden when he was vice president under Obama, and saying they know Saudi Arabia very well. They know Mohammed bin Salman quite well. And I think the Trump administration was very receptive of symbolic or ceremonial interactions, and without necessarily an end goal in mind. They were, you know, when Mohammed bin Salman would welcome Trump and you know, give him a medal and have a sword ceremony and bring Jared Kushner and to these, you know, sort of lavish meetings and make a, like, you know, roll out the red carpet, they saw that as relationship building and something that was meaningful. And I think the Biden administration, from what I know of them, they're much more focused on how does what we do result in what we want. You know, they're trying to, I think, act more intentionally. And it sort of reached the same conclusion, which is, you know, the Trump administration was like, oh, we can't punish him here. And I think the Biden administration saw a couple of things. As Bradley said, like, what are you going to do? It's not like they could really get involved in choosing who the next king of Saudi Arabia is. But another big question is, oh, so you're going to punish the guy for the killing of commentator, but you're not going to do anything about the bombing in Yemen, which I think by any measure is, you know, something that is an ongoing huge humanitarian problem. And so what is to be gained by sanctioning them over one thing? It's saying, oh, don't, you know, you shouldn't kill people symbolically or problematic, but you can kind of do whatever, your military can do whatever it wants. So there wasn't a clear path toward the U.S. changing his behavior in a way that the U.S. wants by sanctioning him for Khashoggi. So I think that's sort of where it ended up.
Do you also believe that part of it is because he may be the crown prince now, but also he's got all these links with world leaders, and potentially they see him now as the next king rather than just the crown prince? Is that another reason as to why they might have not taken a direct stance against him? Because in the future he will probably still be the king, and then it would be a bit of an awkward situation.
No, so yeah, I mean, it's the Omar line from The Wire, which is, you know, it's if you come for the king, you'd best not miss. Meaning, like, I think you're right. They see it as inevitable that he's going to be the king, and they take some symbolic action against him now, that doesn't really have any end goal. It just makes life harder for everyone down the road.
Yeah. No, it's just another example of the way that different countries engage with foreign policy, because obviously between the United States or between the United Kingdom and Saudi Arabia, there's not a lot of shared values, but there are a lot of shared interests. And I think both countries tend to deal with Saudi Arabia through the shared interests prism, because ultimately, Saudi Arabia is such a linchpin in the Middle East. And what people don't often think about is its role internationally through the king's role as the custodian of the two holy cities. And, you know, the kind of global tenor of how Islam is practiced is influenced by what Saudi Arabian government says about how Islam is practiced. Because those religious leaders who are trained in Mecca and Medina, or the kind of religious texts that are sent around the world, recordings of sermons, things like that, it's all sort of mediated by the Saudi Arabian government. And so this is not the kind of, and then you add also this economic dimension we talked about before. Saudi Arabia is a major investor in all these companies. If you were to turn Saudi Arabia into a pariah through isolation, the consequences would be immeasurable potentially.
Do you think this is a scary concept for journalists or activists who have fled Saudi Arabia and now see that they are not safe wherever they may go? That it kind of seems as though Mohammed bin Salman is untouchable. And I imagine if you're in that position that Khashoggi was in, it's a bit terrifying to see, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think Saudi Arabia has ever been a very comfortable place to be a dissident. I mean, obviously, as much as Khashoggi has stained his reputation internationally, I think it has helped him send the message to the Saudi people that it's better not to criticize him publicly. So yeah, I mean, I think there has been a lot of fear among dissidents, and you know, there have been some instances where dissidents abroad were, you know, there was surveillance, there were, you know, their Twitter accounts were hacked. So there's been a lot of that, and I think that is a scary thing. I think one area where, you know, some of the international pressure has worked is, you know, he has released a couple of, you know, high profile dissidents relatively recently, and you know, in some cases they're not allowed to leave Saudi Arabia, and there are other restrictions on them, but. You know, I think there has been some pressure on him to not retaliate in such violent ways. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of fear among the dissident community. People feel like they can't criticize him, even if they believe it's constructive criticism. And that's by design. I think his approach has been that because he is young and because he wasn't, he's almost sort of an unlikely person to be the next king. And because there's such a powerful establishment that he's trying to cast aside, and because he wants to implement so much change and do it so quickly, that there's not really room for him to be publicly criticized. He feels like it gets in the way of his goals, and he's willing to, you know, I think he's shown that he's willing to do whatever he thinks is necessary to clear out obstacles. And it seems as if he counts, you know, critics and dissidents as one of those obstacles.
Well, one of the techniques the old governments of Saudi Arabia used, so they didn't always use kind of aggressive techniques to silence critics. They would, so for example, if there was a prominent critic abroad about Saudi Arabia, instead of making life harder for the family back in Saudi Arabia, they would actually make life easier for them and even try to sort of spread further largesse among those family members of the dissident, sort of making it an economic disincentive. You know, they would use money essentially to keep people in favor of the royal family. And it wouldn't always work. It was sometimes employed as a gentler technique. Whereas in the new Saudi Arabia, it feels a little bit more, you're either with us or against us. And if you're against us, the consequences will be felt across the board. Your family members may have difficulties because of it. There's just a lot more pressure applied. And the other thing that probably slightly, or the other thing that's quite disturbing for any critic of the Saudi regime, is that this crown prince and his team have shown themselves very adept at using technology as well. So, you know, infiltrating Twitter, for example, is one of the parts of our book, how they got inside Twitter. We're finding out information about people who were anonymous critics of the government, finding out things about who they are and where they are located. And then also, obviously, we've seen they're also not afraid to physically send people to go somewhere and talk to somebody on the light end, or worse, on the hard end, you know?
Yeah, it's quite a terrifying concept, I imagine. And I didn't know about the way they would have handled it in the past. And it seems to have grown a little bit more aggressive, to say the least. But obviously, seeing how Mohammed bin Salman is handling all this, would you say that him as the crown prince now is the real ruler, despite not being officially king yet, leaving the current king as a mere figurehead at the minute?
He's definitely not a figurehead. I wouldn't go so far as to say he's the real king either. You know, his father is the king and is very old and has had a series of health problems going back decades. But I think more important than the health problems and more important than his father being ill is the fact that his father has, you know, very explicitly given Mohammed bin Salman control over the military and the economy. And so, you know, while he's not the king, you know, he has the king's mandate to have control over the most important aspects of ruling the country. So he is the day-to-day ruler, you know, and he's been officially designated the day-to-day ruler. So he's basically in charge of Saudi Arabia. But I think it's important to understand that he's not the king yet. And until he officially becomes king, I think it'll be very difficult for him to have more tolerance for criticism. And you know, one of the reasons he's so concerned about things that can get in his way is that he's not king yet. And I think until he becomes king, it's very difficult for him to loosen a lot of these restrictions he's put in place to try to, you know, prevent threats to himself.
Just a small additional thought is essentially the king's role now is for like very high level strategic decisions. So for example, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about this, that when it came to normalizing relations with Israel, Mohammed bin Salman was very much in favor of it, similarly to the United Arab Emirates. But he held back, among the reasons he held back on moving forward with it, was that the king felt very strongly that any kind of normalization needed to have a requisite provision of something to the Palestinians. And the king historically was close to the Palestinians and try to represent their cause in the Gulf. And so he felt, so that's just an example of the king having a really powerful position still, obviously. Everything is done with ultimately his blessing, but there's some things that he gave Mohammed, you know, completely free rein on: the economy, security, culture. That's something that he's really, you know, tourism, all that kind of thing. And then some of these other high level strategic things are still ultimately have to kind of involve the king's buy-in.
Of course. And obviously, you've mentioned that there are certain restrictions on him right now that prevent him from perhaps doing everything that he may want to. Do you think that when he will become king, it will unleash new things that are more controversial or more reformist?
Well, it's hard to predict the future, but if I wanted to take a stab at it, I would say both. I mean, and he's already done things that are very controversial and reformist. You know, I think by any measure, you know, Saudi Arabia has become a more pleasant place to live for people who are 30 and under, which is more than half the population. You can, as Bradley was saying, you can socialize with members of the opposite sex. You can go to the movies. You can go to see live music. You can go to a coffee shop and not have to wait in separate lines if you're a single man or you're in a family. I think those are all reforms. I think there's probably more. I think his plan is to continue to loosen things like that. I don't know what he'll do that's controversial, but his track record so far is that he does whatever he thinks is best. And often what he thinks is best is something that are things that, you know, the international community see as controversial or as overly ambitious. Or so I would expect more of the same for the next several years. Bradley may have a different take than I do.
I don't think we'll see a dramatic change, but there could be some of these quite big topics like normalizing with Israel that could move forward at a different pace. But in general, we already see a lot of Mohammed bin Salman's character stamped across the government and about Saudi society. So I don't think he's being held in check so profoundly that we'll see this kind of completely new change. But, you know, if I'm surprised, I'll be surprised.
I think he's a very interesting character to follow throughout the next 2 years. And like you say, it's very unpredictable, and it will be interesting to see in which direction it's going to take. But just to our listeners as well, just to let you know, if you want to know more about this topic, Bradley and Justin, I've mentioned, they're authors of Blood and Oil, which discusses this topic more in depth, and I definitely recommend going having a look at it. I just have one more question for you, and obviously our podcast is titled The Dark Side of the Middle East, and we have seen a hint of this from Mohammed bin Salman. However, there are other countries such as Dubai who have kind of done certain controversial things as well. And I'm here thinking about Dubai's Princess Latifah. Just a bit of background information for those who may not know. A few years ago, a documentary came out where she basically recorded herself trying to escape and tried to escape to India. However, she was captured. And recently, there was a video that came out of her in confinement, and apparently people who have been in contact with her have said that they have not heard from her for the past year or so. What do you believe this says about other powers in the Middle East? Is it a kind of like a common trend that we see these controversial figures, or is it just a coincidence, do you think?
I think it's hard to expect the kind of behavior you'd want to see in a democracy from a place that's an autocracy, right? So what these countries have in common is they're led by, you know, by a monarch or some version of an inherited all-powerful governance structure, and whoever's in charge can do whatever they want. And so I think unless you have a situation where there's more of a balance of interests among those who are in charge, then you're going to continue to have countries where sometimes, maybe not that often, maybe more often, whoever happens to be in charge is going to do whatever he wants and people aren't going to like it. And so I think, you know, the Gulf monarchies have, you know, become places where there's a lot of international travelers, there's a lot of interconnectedness with the rest of the world, but they're still monarchies. And they're still going to do things in a way that whoever happens to be in charge on that day sees fit. And that's just always going to be the case as long as that's the governance structure, I think. Bradley may have a different take on that.
Yeah, I think in general, the Gulf countries really represent a different worldview than you would find in some of the countries like where we live in the United Kingdom or the United States. So that includes just like your role, the kind of social contract you have, you know, as a resident or a citizen of those countries. But it also, for me, the thing that would be, that's perhaps the most difficult to accept is that the members of the royal families of the Gulf essentially are above the law, because the law in those countries derives from this concept that they are the rulers. You know, that's where it all starts. There's nothing else there. That's what the law is built upon. And so you always see cases over the years of essentially royals behaving badly and getting away with things and not being subject to justice. They tried in Abu Dhabi, for example, there was a Sheikh Issa there's a famous case where there was a video of him sort of like shooting a gun in the ground near this grain merchant and then running him over with a car. I mean, the guy lived, but you know, he was kind of tortured. They claimed to kind of put him on trial to make it look like royals weren't above the law, but that trial was secret and he was acquitted of all charges. So you see things like that. And I think you'll continue to see things like that because these aren't societies built upon the rule of law. They're built on the rule of the royal family.
Of course, I agree. And just one last question. Do you think that is it the place of institutions like the UN perhaps to get involved and implement changes, or do you not see this as possible or even right at all? Because is their own country, they should rule it as they see fit, or is there room for institutions like the UN to come in and say, hold on a second, you need to rethink these decisions and these attitudes?
I think, you know what, these international organizations can't change anything within Saudi Arabia, but what they can do is say, listen, if you act in these ways, or if you break some kind of a law, or, you know, you do something that we find objectionable on human rights standards, then you can't have certain privileges in other countries in the world. So that's where things like sanctions come in. They're saying, listen, we can't put you in prison for what you did. That's a Saudi matter, but we can say that we don't accept this kind of international behavior. And often it comes down to things about money, you know, about making it impossible for certain people to do business in their countries or preventing them from traveling there, things like that. And that seems to be a pretty effective tool on some level, because the last thing anybody wants, whether it's a Russian oligarch or, you know, a member of this Tiger Squad, is to be on an international sanctions list. You know, basically makes you a pariah. You can't travel to all the places you want to travel. You can't open bank accounts sometimes. So I think that's been the primary tool alongside public relations. It's unlikely to change. And I can't really see any mechanisms where it could become more aggressive than that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's something that we or other institutions like that cannot really get involved. And it's just something we have to see how it'll progress throughout time. I just want to say thank you to Justin and Bradley so much for joining us today and talking to us about this. Again, if you want to know more about what we have discussed today, have a look at their book, Blood and Oil. It has amazing insights of this. It explores more on this topic. And I think we've gained a lot from today's conversation.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
No, thank you.